Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Litigation Costs and Debt Collection Disputes Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On November 7, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Marks v. General Revenue Corporation, which concerns the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, or FDCPA, and the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. The FDCPA authorizes a judge to award costs and reasonable attorney's fees to a defendant if the judge determines that the plaintiff brought his or her FDCPA lawsuit in bad faith and for the purpose of harassing the defendant. The question in Marks is whether, where there is no finding of bad faith, a prevailing defendant in an FDCPA case can nevertheless obtain an award of costs under the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54D, which generally allows an award of costs, but not attorney's fees, to a prevailing party in a civil litigation unless a federal statute, these federal rules, or a court order provides otherwise. To discuss the case, we have Charles Keckler, who serves on the Board of Directors of the Legal Services Corporation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Keckler.
With a controversy entitled Marks v. General Revenue Corporation, you might expect a world historical clash of economic philosophies. However, it's actually a statutory interpretation issue, but if not quite Hegelian, it is important for how the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, henceforth FDCPA, will operate going forward, based on the interaction of one of its key provisions with Rule 54 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. The plaintiff, Olivier Marks, had undergone some training as a medical assistant. According to her, she thought the money she received for her education was a grant. Actually, it turned out to be a loan, one she was unable or unwilling to pay back. She's a struggling single mom with a couple of little kids, trying to wheedle child support out of their dad, and her situation got tougher when the debt collector, that's the defendant GRC, started coming after her, sending faxes to her job, calling her, and so forth. GRC is a company controlled ultimately by the heavyweight, Sallie Mae, and Marks alleged GRC used abusive and unlawful tactics trying to get her to pay, and she filed a complaint under the FDCPA. Marks rejected a settlement offer and took her case all the way to a bench trial at Federal District Court. She lost on every count. Under the default rule for federal civil trials, specifically Rule 54D, the loser of a case has responsibility to pay the costs of the winner, a set of specified charges that includes witness fees and the costs of producing transcripts, among other permitted items. GRC, as the prevailing party, used this rule to request about $7,800 in taxable costs and was actually awarded by the judge about $4,500. Rule 54D essentially codifies the American rule of litigation costs. Absent some other provision, winners must pay their own attorney's fees, but they may be, and regularly are, awarded certain other costs. Why fees are not costs would probably take another podcast to explain, although it does show the rule was written by lawyers and not by accountants. But as you'll see in a minute, it's important to be clear on the distinction between fees and costs. Marks appealed. She objected to the costs and contested substantively an adverse ruling about whether the collection tactics of GRC had crossed the line. She lost in the Tenth Circuit on both points, 2-1 over a dissent. But as the Supreme Court only granted cert on the Rule 54 question, we'll focus on that. Marks's essential argument here has been that the operation of Rule 54 should be superseded by more specific provisions of the FDCPA, which she interprets as barring any cost recovery, absent a showing of bad faith on her part, which there was none. This argument has been effective in a Ninth Circuit case, Rouse v. Law Offices of Rory Clark, and in some district courts, but the Tenth Circuit found it unpersuasive. In ruling for GRC, the Court of Appeals created a circuit split, which no doubt piqued the Supreme Court's interest. Another reason the court may have taken Marks's case, and certainly the reason the United States became involved in the matter, on the side of Marks as the plaintiff petitioner, is that there are important policy consequences at play here, which are worth reviewing before discussing the specific dispute about interpreting the FDCPA's language. Most cases brought under the FDCPA involve low-dollar amounts of actual damages. There are statutory damages of up to $1,000 for violations, and occasionally, in egregious cases, debt collector harassment will result in substantial actual damages, usually under an intentional infliction of emotional distress theory. Generally, though, the economics of these cases are driven by the fact that if plaintiffs win, they get not only damages and costs, but also attorney's fees, a one-way statutory repeal of the American rule. You find provisions of this sort in remedial civil rights statutes and other places as a way to encourage private enforcement of the legislation. The way it usually works for the FDCPA is that lawyers, often specializing in this area of law, take cases on contingency, minimizing risk for the plaintiff, and aim for a settlement. One amicus brief estimated the common settlement value in the $2,500 to $7,500 range. If the case goes to judgment, the principal recovery will turn out to be plaintiff's attorney's fees, with a relatively small award to the plaintiff. You're probably beginning to see how Rule 54 could create major disincentives for plaintiffs not suing for substantial actual damages, i.e. most plaintiffs, since under the rule, they, not the attorneys, are responsible for taxable costs. Even if costs amount to only a few $1,000s, this will often transform anything but a slam-dunk lawsuit into an expected loss. At the least, it will make private enforcement of the types of violations normally remedied by statutory damages much riskier personally for the litigant. Nor do FDCPA plaintiffs generally have a few $1,000s to risk on making a moral or legal point. That's why they're being aggressively pursued by debt collectors in the first place. The new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, represented at the SCOTUS by the Solicitor General's office, expressed a concern about what they termed a chilling effect of the Tenth Circuit's decision, and brought up this point in their briefs and at oral argument. Meanwhile, appearing as amici, organizations of debt collectors and their attorneys strongly suggested that much of FDCPA litigation currently consists of meritless nuisance lawsuits, and that the operation of Rule 54 would provide a meaningful and salutary deterrent effect on low-value, low-probability claims. An empirically minded Justice Breyer engaged with the attorney from the Solicitor General's office on this point, having actually done his own sampling of cost awards. According to Justice Breyer, the $4,500 awarded here is a bit on the high side, but it's quite common to have $1,000 to a few $1,000s in costs. Given the frequently low amount of actual damages, I think it remains plausible that a decision in this case could influence litigant behavior going forward under the FDCPA. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, of course, depends on where you sit. But taxability of costs matters more than one might think to the overall operation of the statute here. Although the respondent GRC pointed out the operation of Rule 54 can often be moderated by judicial discretion upon a claim of indigence, there still could be noticeable deterrent effects on bringing FDCPA suits with low expected damages and significant chance of loss. Now with that background, to the actual issue on which Marks appealed, in which the court needs to decide. FRCP 54D says, quote, unless a federal statute, these rules, or a court order provides otherwise, costs, other than attorney's fees, should be allowed to the prevailing party, unquote. Notice here the key phrase, provides otherwise. That's what Marks slash the administration claim the FDCPA does, and what GRC says it does not do. The FDCPA, specifically 15 U.S.C. 1692K, has two sentences. The first sentence says that the plaintiff will get, quote, in the case of any successful action to enforce the foregoing liability, the costs of the action, together with a reasonable attorney's fee, as determined by the court, unquote. That's a supersession of the American rule. Notice it does describe both costs, which you might get anyway under Rule 54, as well as the fees. The second sentence is what the court spent most of its time on. It says, on a finding by the court that an action under this section was brought in bad faith and for the purpose of harassment, the court may award to the defendant's attorney's fees reasonable in relation to the work expended and costs, unquote. Certainly, the FDCPA does make some provision for costs. Unlike Rule 54, which sharply distinguishes fees and costs, the statute treats them in parallel, but only awards them when certain conditions hold, namely, either a plaintiff win, or, going the other way, a finding of plaintiff bad faith. What the FDCPA doesn't do is explicitly provide for this case, in which there is neither a plaintiff victory nor bad faith. To assume that it displaces Rule 54 requires one to infer an exclusion into the statute, that the FDCPA is to be read as implying defendants only get costs if they show bad faith and not otherwise. Justice Scalia expressed immediate skepticism about judicially filling in gaps in legislation by assuming such, quote, negative implication. That's the inclusio unius, exclusio alterius canon of construction, for those of you following along in Latin. One thing that cuts a bit against applying this canon is that in the earlier form of Rule 54, it required an express provision of a different statute to displace its operation. And as the United States conceded, the current wording of simply provides otherwise was intended as a purely stylistic change to express provision. In addition to the inclusio canon, Marx's argument relies on the canon against superfluous language. If Congress wanted to retain Rule 54 in the background, she says, the phrase "and costs" in the second sentence would have to be surplusage, because successful defendants would get costs anyhow. That's what Judge Lucero in the Tenth Circuit thought in his dissent, and since surplusage is disfavored, the best way to implement intent, Marx claims, is to assume Congress hitched costs to bad faith in the FDCPA, and the default rule is not intended to operate. The counterargument is that the presence of the phrase "and costs" is mainly just belt and suspenders in both the first plaintiff and second defendant sentences of the provisions of the FDCPA. If Congress hadn't said costs, people would wonder. Further, the second sentence does some work Rule 54 doesn't, since technically defendants don't have to prevail under the FDCPA. Bad faith actions settled or withdrawn can still result in relief for defendants in the statute. The parties basically came to agree during argument that if Congress hadn't added those last two words, "and costs," there could be no negative implication of providing otherwise to Rule 54, meaning Marx would surely lose. So what did Congress mean by adding those two words? Did they mean to comprehensively legislate on defendants' right to taxation of costs? Plaintiff in the USA say yes. The defendant says no. There's not much legislative history to help the court decide here about the mischievous phrase "and costs," but there is a Senate report from 1977 that suggests the second sentence about bad faith actions was put in to help defendants. As was brought out by respondents and their amici, mainly in the briefs, as a practical matter, defendants would be far better off without that second supposedly protective sentence if Marx's interpretation were to prevail here. Under the plaintiff view, the inclusion of that second sentence takes away, by negative implication, the ordinary taxation of costs, which is a significant deterrent and recovery in relation to most FDCPA claims, and gives back only a bad faith recovery that would be difficult and prohibitively expensive to litigate. If you think Congress was sincere in trying to throw a bone to defendants here, then you have to assume they did a pretty poor job of doing so if you adopt the plaintiff's view. Essentially, the idea is that it's odd to construe Congress as intending in the same words to give with one hand and take away with the other. Defendants' position is that Rule 54 is in the background of the FDCPA and was meant to govern those situations not expressly provided for. Justice Breyer, adopting an analogy from GRC's brief, put the logic this way. Suppose you're a parent with two kids and you say, if you tease your sister, I'm going to give her your allowance and her allowance. That doesn't mean the sister loses her allowance if you don't tease her. In this homespun example, then, teasing is bad faith and warrants fees and costs. But not teasing could still leave a background entitlement to costs in place. This interpretation reconciles the FDCPA with Rule 54 in this general idea, despite the possible statutory surplusage, seemed appealing to several justices during the course of the argument. To restate the question, Congress said something about costs in a statute, although it wasn't explicit about this set of circumstances, much less about displacing the general rule. Is legislating generally on the issue enough to supersede Rule 54's activity? Justice Kagan, from her questions, seemed inclined toward finding this sufficient, and thus agreeing with Marx and the Obama administration. The other justices who spoke, everybody but Justice Thomas in his usual practice, as well as Justice Alito and Justice Kennedy, certainly seemed more skeptical in varying degrees. Several justices seemed to be tending toward the position that for the plaintiff to prevail, Congress would have had to have been at least a bit clearer that costs were only available under bad faith. And it may be worth noting that both Justice Alito and Justice Kennedy dissented in an FDCPA case a couple of years ago called German, using language that suggested they view the FDCPA as somewhat overweighted toward plaintiffs already. Plaintiff and the United States have to be nervous after this argument. If abiding the danger of doing so, you base a prediction on the kinds of concerns the justices expressed about legislating around the federal rules protections for defendants via negative implication, particularly when this occurs in the context of purportedly helping defendants, you would probably say that respondent is likely to have won at least 5 votes. But my guess is just that, a guess, and comes with all the appropriate caveats.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.